Welcome to session four of the Yoga Sutra book study group. Our session tonight is Ishvara, Our Eternal Guide, Sutras 123 to 129. And this is a cluster of sutras that is vast. I've sometimes spent days, week, 10 days just on this cluster alone. What we'll do is we'll look at the essence of what is trying to be conveyed here. And before we dive into the sutras, we'll take a step back and look at where we come from. And return back to the very simple idea that all of the Yoga Sutras is trying to help us understand this essential goal of all human life, termed as samadhi, an experience of our essential self nature. And in that context, we've been exploring how abhyasa and vairagya are that twofold path that leads us to samadhi. Abhyasa, cultivating that peaceful flow of awareness, and vairagya, the process of transforming our self-identity so that we can find the best in ourself, and how abhyasa and vairagya really support each other. Each catalyzes the other. Each motivates the other, which is why they're so intertwined, so interdependent. And that through this mutually driven process of abhyasa and vairagya, an amazing inner transformation takes place, which culminates in samadhi. And we spent a good amount of time last week looking at these five unique principles of self-mastery that can breathe further life into our practice of vairagya and abhyasa. And it led us to a point where we saw that, the context there is that it's helping us to understand the tools that we have available to us and how we can find concrete ways to work with our mind, to work with abhyasa and vairagya. But the amazing thing is that when the very ending point of last week, on page 105, led us to an amazing statement that the very last sentence in the final paragraph on page 105 says, "Trustful surrender laden with gratitude yokes us to our practice." Ultimately, samadhi is the culmination of our abhyasa and vairagya. It's like a fruit which is ripening and maturing on a tree. There's a natural process, that ripening process. Our abhyasa and vairagya continue to unfold. There's a very natural force behind it. And at some point, it reaches its culmination, where there's completion. We've done our part. Our abhyasa and vairagya is complete to the extent that that's complete within the extent of what is ours to do. And only we know what that point is. And there's a very clear recognition that this is a very personal path. Everyone's understanding of what abhyasa and vairagya means to them will be distinct. There's a sense of completion, a sense of fullness. And at that point, that final step unveils itself. Keep one more thing in mind, that when we were looking at the definition of vairagya, abhyasa is very technique-oriented, which is why the literal translation is practice. It's something we can do. There are milestones. Even the literal translation of a peaceful flow of awareness, we know that there's many different degrees of that peaceful flow of awareness. Vairagya is this continual process of refining our self-identity. And in part, it's a process. In part, there's a technique where the abhyasa fully motivates that. But what we saw is that that aspect of vairagya, which is more of the practice of vairagya, if you will, the process of vairagya, was divided into four states of lower vairagya. Higher vairagya is not considered to be a process. It's a state of realization. And It is the that which brings us to samadhi or brings samadhi to us, not the abhyasa. That's a very important thing to remember before we get into sutras 123 to 129. That simple statement made much earlier about higher vairagya, that number one, this pinnacle of the refinement of our self-identity is not another layer of the technique of yoga, even the practice of yoga, but it's a condensed, mature, fully ripened state of realization. And our effort is part of that process of our vairagya maturing and ripening, but there's something more. Just like how we tend to a tree, the nutrients, the water that we give to it, all the climatic conditions, partially we can influence, but the force of time itself in that particular example, in the example of a tree, a fruit on a tree ripening, is beyond the control of the tree or the gardener. There's some unique force which is helping that process of the fruit maturing to happen. Similarly, in our vairagya, there's something more besides our practice of abhyasa or this process of vairagya. That leads us to this, what's defined as higher vairagya, para vairagya. That culmination of this subtle but powerful process of refining how we see ourselves and how we see the world, which one day allows us to be fully embraced by a reality that underpins the totality of our existence. That is that final stage of vairagya, which is that final lift that brings us to whatever this term samadhi is talking about. It's not our effort, but rather grace, which dawns in the form of this higher vairagya, the state of realization. That state of realization, that higher vairagya, is exactly synonymous with Ishwar Pranidhana, which is the topic that we'll get into in 123. So go back to those sutras on vairagya, and that'll give a little bit of context. Because the biggest question that really often we begin with when we jump into 123 to 129 is, what is this all about? Why are we discussing Ishwara and Ishwara Pranidhana in context to the path of yoga and the goal of reaching samadhi? Is Ishwara necessary or not? Is Ishwara Pranidhana another path to reach samadhi, or is it a requirement? Very important questions, especially because the word Ishwara is almost always translated as God. And for many people, that word has a lot of baggage. That word brings more doubt and potentially fear rather than hope and excitement and a sense of empowerment. So these cluster of sutras usually are a source of anxiety and confusion, and they don't need to be. So the first thing we remember is what I just read on page 105, that there's a clear statement being made in context to that sutra, which was looking at how there's various degrees of intensity of our practice. And depending on the intensity of our practice, how quickly we reach there, samadhi, is influenced by that. And this intensity is not how hard we work. It's not like a physical workout, but rather the quality of our knowledge and the quality of our gratitude. That was another point that we looked at there. Knowledge and gratitude have everything to do with this idea of Ishwar Pranidhana, which is loosely translated as trustful surrender. In the commentary on 123, and the Sutra 123 is a very, very short sutra, which says, Ishwara Pranidhanad Va. From Ishwara Pranidhana, which is usually translated as trustful surrender, to Ishwara, samadhi also comes. Trustful surrender. Does everyone need to trustfully surrender to Ishvara to reach samadhi or not? The answer is yes, but it's interesting to look at it from the perspective of the two different categories of yogis that we looked at earlier, upaya pratyaya yogis and bhava pratyaya yogis. Upaya pratyaya yogis are those yogis who still are working to gain maturity in the practice of yoga and trying to see how abhyasa and vairagya can become integral to our being, like a default mode, that it becomes a skill, a quality that is so innate to us that we no longer need to really work hard to allow it to manifest. We gave the example of how in any profession, in any unique human achievement skill, there's a certain phase where we're working to make it innate, and then there's another phase of mastery where it's so innate to someone that they're able to express it and it seems effortless. That's what's being described here. Not that there's good yogis and subpar yogis, but yogis who are still working to assimilate abhyasa and vairagya and make it their swabhava, their self-nature. In these cases, trustful surrender usually seems like the last option because there's a very powerful identification towards or dependency on abhyasa and vairagya. This is mine to do. I'm going to do it really, really well. And I don't need to give up. I'm the doer. This is working well. I'm seeing progress. And why do I need to seek outside help is usually the feeling that comes up. It's a very natural feeling. I got this. I've got this totally under control. Fantastic progress. And I'll be there just in a matter of days, months, and even if it's years, not a big deal. It's often when a major, seemingly insurmountable obstacle arises that we feel overwhelmed. And in those kind of circumstances, a sense of needing something beyond my current capacity to help me take the next step comes up. Then the idea of trustful surrender often comes to mind. And in that case, the literal translation of using the word surrender is a very accurate word. We've been defeated. We've not found the capacity to overcome. Therefore, often in a very pitiful condition, or a condition accompanied by pain and disappointment, let's put it this way, we seek this idea of trustful surrender. Is this a bad thing or not? No, it's not a bad thing. This is the reality. And yet, it's not an expression of Ishvara Pranidhana, which is very inspiring, and it's not the totality of Ishvara Pranidhana. And that kind of Ishvara Pranidhana probably is not what Patanjali is talking about here that can lead us to samadhi. It leads us to the next stage of our own inner growth and unfoldment. We need a boost. We need to find some relief. We need to find a way to see ourselves in a new light, which is not defined by whatever particular limitation which has become all-consuming. Pain often is a big part of that. But it's even though this might sound a little bit like an unpleasant truth or an overly judgmental way of looking at it, it's one that many of us have probably seen before. And certainly one of the primary ways that trustful surrender comes about. It's not even plan B or C, it's like Z. Last option, we've given up. Compare that to bhava pratyaya yogis, these yogis who have absorbed and assimilated abhyasa and vairagya to the point where it becomes almost like part of their self-nature. Ishvara Pranidhana is not only the last option, it's not even in the middle, it's the very top on the list. It's the best option. But there's also a clarity of understanding that it is the simplest, but certainly not the easiest. Tremendous degree of preparation goes into allowing Ishvara Pranidhana to be the best option. That recognition, that clarity of thought is very much present. That just because it's the simplest doesn't mean that it's the easiest. And it absolutely is opposite to the idea that it requires no preparation. It's the culmination of our abhyasa and vairagya. The final stage of our abhyasa and vairagya is Ishvara Pranidhana. And we see that we've been able to assimilate Abhyasa and Vairagya quite well. Therefore, the opportunity for Ishwar Pranidhana is within sight. And it's an Ishwar Pranidhana that's not an option that's coming to mind because there's any external circumstance or limitation that we're experiencing, but because the critical mass of our Abhyasa and Vairagya has really reached there. The commentary here, I think, uses the word that Abhava Pratyayogi see it as an inescapable reality. That it becomes like the dawn of the sun when the sun is so big that that's all you can see. It completely consumes the totality of our awareness. It's the only option. Not because we're disempowered, but because we've become so complete that it presents itself to us. Ishwar Parinidhana is not at all surrender for Bhava Pratyayogis. It's the greatest opportunity, which requires tremendous preparation. What kind of preparation? Exactly where we left 122. A highly refined awareness, a highly refined knowledge and sense of gratitude together. We're tremendously clear about what Ishwara is and completely full of gratitude towards that. That opens the door to Ishwara Pranidhana, not any sense of disempowerment. That sounds wonderful. We all aspire to be Bhava Pratyayogis. And it's simple. Continue on the path of Abhyasa and Vairagya without worrying about when it'll be enough. That's exactly when it starts to be enough, that it becomes our swabhava, our self-nature. We enjoy it. And there's more and more and more critical mass built. Then, spontaneously, we seek Ishwara Pranidhana, and it seeks us. It's not the last option. It's not the first option. It's the only option in the sense that it's the culmination of our journey. A very simple question comes from there. That makes complete sense. I need to do my work. I need to grow on the path of yoga. I need to find the essence of Abhyasa and Vairagya. Allow it to become me. So that I can gain the knowledge and gratitude to experience Ishwara Pranidhana. Who is Ishwara? Who is Ishwara? What is Ishwara? I need to know more. My knowledge and my gratitude need to expand in richness, in subtlety, in potency, so that I can be prepared for trustfully allowing myself to be embraced and embracing Ishwara. Am I ready for it? And do I still see this Ishwara stuff, otherwise known as God, as something or someone far away out there, or not? Is there something more? That's exactly where 124 comes in. In fact, 124, 125, 126 should be studied together. It's the nucleus of most essential way of understanding who Ishwara is. It's understanding what this reality is all about. 124, very simply, says, and it's very simple but extremely compact. In fact, this particular sutra is immense. That's why it can easily take days or weeks or longer to really study. Klesha karma vipaka ashaira param rishtaha purusha vishesha ishwaraha. We'll just talk about the essence of what this sutra talks about and shares. That goes to the most important understanding that can help us form a relationship with Ishwara. First thing about Ishwara is that I usually hesitate to translate Ishwara as God. Although, as you can see in the commentary, that hesitation usually, that word is used quite often. One other word that, and the reason I hesitate is that sometimes it puts too much of a barrier between us and what's trying to be conveyed. Too much energy spent in trying to decondition ourselves to how we've understood that word to be. I personally have no issue. And I come from an orientation where it's very comfortable, but I can also imagine why there might be other perspectives where Even the idea of God, using the word God implies many, many more things that Patanjali might not have intended. So let's start with being comfortable with the word Ishwara as Ishwara. And if we're looking for another word, use the word higher reality. Because it helps us to understand that Ishwara is not a person, a thing, a place. It's far more subtle and far more expansive. Which is why the idea of surrender or defeat doesn't really come in. It's not a idea of victory or surrender has to do with a very specific personal relationship. This is something which is far, far, far bigger than that and richer than that. And it's an all-pervading field of awareness. Much of the path of yoga is talking about how we cultivate a more refined flow of awareness. That's exactly where abhyasa comes in. We're trying to gain a deeper mastery of the mind through a peaceful flow of awareness. We talked a little bit about how it doesn't necessarily imply inner flow of awareness or external flow, but across the board, peaceful flow of awareness. Awareness, our capacity to experience reality. Everything that we experience through this peaceful flow of awareness defines our reality. When it's a non-peaceful flow of awareness, there's a lot of strain and stress and pain in that reality. As we grow more mature in abhyasa, this peaceful flow of awareness, our reality becomes more and more peaceful, more and more rich, subtle, potent, and expansive. But nonetheless, it's our self-created reality. It becomes much better, but it's still limited by our awareness. The question arises, is the universe only as big as I know it to be? Am I only as big as I know myself to be? I often use this analogy of trying to count to infinity one at a time. We're trying to experience ourselves in a limitless grandeur, one experience at a time, which is why it's taking a long time. And I'm not talking about a lifetime being a long time. Billions of lifetimes, if not a word even bigger than that. It's like one snapshot at a time. Again and again, and it's wonderful. There's tremendous richness in this. This is not a criticism. But we will never be able to experience the totality of ourself or the universe in this kind of way. We haven't fully been convinced of this yet. And also there's so much excitement in the effort to see ourselves this way that we get a little distracted. Ishwara is pointing at a higher reality, which is independent of what we understand it to be today. It answers the very simple question, does my world and the universe at large rest on something more than I can understand or not? Yoga is very clearly saying that yes, it does. The universe did not come out of nothingness. Our personal life and our identity didn't come out of nothingness. It rests on a much richer and more primordial reality, which, for the sake of discussion here, we can call Ishwara. We have a source. And all of us are trying to understand the totality of reality. And don't think of it in a cosmic sense or universal sense. Ourself. Who are we? And everything we do is in service of that desire. Ishwara is the essence of that desire. And the culmination of our journey to understand ourselves. It's a reality that we don't need to define for ourselves, but rather which is our own nature, and which is so vast that it can contain everything that we could possibly know and imagine and beyond. It's the source. That's why it's higher reality. And that's why Ishwara is not a thing or a person that we surrender ourselves to, but a state of realization that we're embraced by. Go back to the Vairagya discussion. We're working on our self-identity. We're refining how we see ourselves. We're transforming these samskaras. We're growing happier and happier, more and more expansive. And ultimately, the only identity which is left is pure awareness. And that might remind us of those different stages of samadhi, which we'll come back to in a few sessions. Ishvara is that identity, if you will, and the word identity is too small of a word, but it helps in understanding how this is all put together. Ishvara is that culmination of our vairagya, the refinement of our self-identity that we're seeking. The way that Patanjali literally defines Ishvara is fascinating, which is why it's a little bit of a complex thing. 124, the Sanskrit that I just read to you, covers a number of very specific attributes. And even the word attribute is a little small because it makes it seem like there's certain ways that Ishvara looks. It's not how Ishvara looks, but intrinsic qualities that are unique and in the very literal sense, one of a kind, that are unique to Ishvara and no other being. And a very amazing statement is implicit there, that we're not saying that this or such and such is Ishvara. Ishvara is the higher reality which has such and such qualities. It's the qualities which define Ishvara. Not that any human being is defining Ishvara to be such and such. And that leads to a number of intriguing things about, is Ishvara one or many? And many more interesting metaphysical questions. What we'll talk about here is a little bit about these unique qualities in relation to how we see ourselves and why Ishvara is distinct from who we are and why Ishvara as a higher reality is that foundation upon which we can reach the essence of ourself. We can find the essence of ourself. There's a much bigger discussion on Sankhya metaphysics and yoga metaphysics on the idea of Purusha, Prakriti, many more technical terms that are in the book. And there's a beautiful Appendix C that talks a lot more about Sankhya. What we'll mention here is that saying that Ishvara is the essence of pure consciousness is a very accurate statement. And that comes from the word Purusha. The literal translation here is that Ishvara is a special Purusha, special consciousness. And that all of us are seeds of consciousness. And the term that this commentary and most commentaries choose to use is the word ordinary Purusha. And that Ishvara is an extraordinary, unique Purusha, one of a kind. Not judgmental. It's not that human beings, all of us, are inferior. We're trying to see what does it really mean to unfold the best in ourself. That's one of the other translations of the goals of yoga I used earlier. Finding the best in ourself and allowing, embracing it, and more importantly, allowing ourselves to be embraced by that best in ourself. That's Ishvara, the extraordinary Purusha within. And these four qualities are what make Ishvara Purusha Vishesha, the special, unique Ishvara. First, Ishvara is not bound by the kleshas, these primordial afflictions, is not and has never been limited, defined by, under the influence of the kleshas. It leads to a really big discussion on kleshas, avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. Attachment, aversion, ignorance, a distorted sense of self-identity, attachment, aversion, and the fear of death or fear of loss of our identity. And we'll come back to that when we study Sadhanapada, the second book, many sessions from now. But just think about this. Vairagya is working with our identity, our samskaras, all of these seeds within ourself. These samskaras are seeds of these different kleshas. They're literally how we see ourselves, our likes and our dislikes. Our our self-created identities, which we hold on to because they're comfortable. All of that together is avidya. Seeing the real and the unreal. And from the perspective of samadhi, everything outside of our essential self nature is unreal. Not good or bad, but it's not our essential nature. It's very, very transitory and extremely relative. There's no absolute value in anything outside of ourself. But we've become quite convinced that there's an absolute sense of good or bad, painful or pleasant experience. All of that put together is what it means to be defined by the kleshas. It's a reality that is not grounded in essence of truth. And a reality which definitely has quite a bit of distortion. Ishwara is a reality that's never suffered from any distortion. It's pristine. It's our source. It's that capacity that allows us to transcend the most subtle of our samskaras because it doesn't contain any of those qualities. That leads me to the second of the unique attributes. The first one was that Ishwara was never under the influence of or defined by any of the kleshas, any of the afflictions. Ishwara is untouched by karma. Again, we'll go into a much deeper discussion, but anytime we perform an action, by virtue of performing it, it becomes ours. And it's really subtle, really powerful. It's almost impossible at this stage in our evolution to be the doer without being quite identified as the doer. It's ours. And the only reason why that's a problem is that those actions define how we see ourselves, and more specifically, the outcome of those actions. We're more than this. It goes back to my analogy of needing to weave the infinite from one experience at a time, serially. That's what karma is all about. That perfection can never be reached one at a time. It is complete. It's infinity. And the law of action itself is that each action is mine, each action is singular, beginning, middle, end. And it sets a wheel in motion where it spins off another and another and another. By its very nature, it's a limitation. Karma has, every action has in effect, karma vipaka, the third quality that Ishwara is not touched by. Ishwara can be the pure conduit of action without having, it's interesting, the literal translation of this word is post-digestive effect. When you eat something, you feel something later. Ishwara can consume every action and transform that action into pure power, pure experience. There's no heartburn. There's nothing. There's no post-digestive effect. It's not that Ishwara is completely uninvolved and checked out. Found the escape hatch, gone, done, away from all this mess. Fully engaged. And so fully engaged, engaged with such perfection that each action is complete and doesn't reflect on the perfection of Ishwara. And ultimately, the fourth quality, karmashaya, Ishwara doesn't need to own the outcome of every single action because everything is within Ishwara. That's the difference here. We still feel the need to hang on to every single outcome because that's what makes us complete. Accumulation. Little bit more, a little bit more. Counting to infinity, and we're almost there. The next one is going to get us there. We've seen 99.99% of the universe. The last galaxy is the last one. Let's move on to that. Everything is within Ishwara. Everything is fully known. Everything is fully assimilated. There's no need to even have this awareness of my own karmic identity. So, Ishwara is that special Purusha which is free from the kleshas, karma, outcome of karmas, and karmic identity, holding on to this. And not just that transcendence was found, but intrinsically, innately, Ishwara has always been free of these. If it sounds like a really big idea, it is. If it sounds like, gosh, I need to really think about whether or not this is even possible, that's a very honest answer. That's why it's, for now, the word trustful surrender might be a very apt translation, because it's beyond what I can understand, imagine, or beyond what I'm prepared to accept. I'll take it on faith. I'll hope that this is true because it sounds amazing and slightly beyond what I can conceive of right now. That's honest and that's okay. What I would say to that is work with kleshas, karma, karma vipaka, and karmashaya, abhyasa and vairagya. And all we have to ask ourselves is to have the courage, clarity, confidence to see how our practice of yoga, our abhyasa and vairagya, can lead to more and more and more mastery over kleshas and everything to do with our karma, which is split into those three parts. And we can see progress. All of us see progress. All we have to do is kind of extrapolate that to an extraordinary extent and see that, yes, that destination point, that culmination is there. Tremendous degree of mastery. And the only last leap, which is even one step beyond, is there's a reality which was never defined in the way that I'm currently defined today. But leave that till quite a bit later. As we keep getting more and more and more refined in our experience, the possibility for Ishwara Pranidhana grows stronger and stronger, more and more clear. And at some point, which is what I was referring to earlier, it's not a possibility. It goes from a possibility to a probability, and then it moves to a concrete reality. It is truth. It's exactly where I know I'm going. It's an inescapable reality, to use the words that are in this commentary. I know it, I feel it. It's my home. It's my destination. And even more importantly, it's who I am already. But I need to do my part. I need to walk on this path till the very last step and be fully engaged with my abhyasa and vairagya until I have the capacity to allow Ishwara Pranidhana to walk into my life. But we have to want it to walk into our life. And number two, we absolutely have to do our part. Which leads me back to one of those questions I asked, that is it an either or? Is it either do everything that we've already talked about, abhyasa, vairagya, all that great stuff, or Ishwara Pranidhana? It's both. We have to do our part, and then it's not that we have a choice of whether or not to really see that Ishwara Pranidhana is an option, but rather it becomes the culmination of our abhyasa and vairagya. They go hand in hand. If we see it as the quick and easy way out now, it means that we didn't find the full expression of our abhyasa and vairagya. And that kind of Ishwara Pranidhana, even if it momentarily brings us to samadhi, we won't be able to stay there. And there's a much richer discussion about that later on. But that's an amazing point. There's clarity, sometimes that sense of surrender where we've exhausted our capacity does allow us to reach a peak experience. But the ability to retain it comes from the maturity of our abhyasa and vairagya. So it's not that the idea of surrender is such a bad thing. It won't help us stay and remain in that space. And we're really shooting for the best. So Ishwara Pranidhana, it means how we unpack this huge, huge, huge idea of Ishwara. So we only covered 124. Let me move a little bit further ahead. Couldn't see I'm having difficulty making sure that we cover everything in time. 125. Tatra Niratishaya Sarvagya Bijam. These next two sutras talk about a unique quality of Ishwara. The first definition was really big, as you saw. A reality that's not defined by all those limitations. Ishwara is that reality in which resides the unsurpassed seed of omniscience. The fact that Ishwara is not defined or limited by time, space, and the law of cause and effect is exceptional. It truly is unique. Ishwara is that reality which is not defined by time, space, or the law of cause and effect. We all know that our reality is very much conditioned by these three. That's an amazing aspect of yoga metaphysics about how time, space, and the law of cause and effect are a unique conditioning of our experience of reality, but they're not universal. There's a way to transcend them. Why is that important? When our knowledge is limited by time and space, it means that our knowledge is quite fragmented. Ishwara's knowledge is truly infinite. It's truly primordial, not bound by time, and nothing is outside the scope of Ishwara's awareness. That's why it's higher reality. That's why in Ishwara lies the seed of omniscience, that capacity for complete knowledge. That's exactly what we're seeking. For some choice things to read to you. Take that one step further in Sutra 126. Ishwara is that reality in which the seed of unsurpassed omniscience resides. This is what allows Ishwara to be the teacher of all previous teachers. It's the literal translation of 126. We're looking for Ishwara not as a God who rewards or punishes, but rather we're looking for that inner essence which allows us to truly know and have the experience for ourselves. Ishwara is the inner teacher. This is a word that's used quite a bit, a word that sometimes we don't really know what we mean, but deep in our heart we know that it's very, very, very important. That we need to find that force of guidance, nourishment, and protection that can help us on every level, whenever we need, wherever we are. That's exactly what Ishwara is all about. And this is exactly where it ties into Pranidhana. We're not surrendering to an enemy or to someone who is bigger or smaller than us. We are finding that essence of ourself, that inner teacher who is always with us, to know how we can find the best in ourself and unfold it. Ishwara is that guiding force within that opens the gateway to everything that we already are. That's the amazing mystery behind all of life and behind this idea of samadhi. We're not trying to find something which didn't exist in the first place. We're not trying to create something which didn't exist in the first place. It's not a matter of accumulating more and more and more until we have enough. We're trying to find that which is already there. We need to find the key. That's why this idea of Ishwara Pranidhana is so central. To the point where there's so much emphasis maybe placed on this that it can almost scare us away a little bit. Abhyasa and Vairagya, our work, at least for now, looks like it's 99% of it. It's really what is ours to do. But that last 1% makes a big difference, huge difference. We might grow very, very powerful, with tremendous capacity, but our ability to find ourselves and reside there will never be within our reach until our relationship to our inner teacher is awakened. So one broader thought about all of these sutras in 123 to 129. Ishwara Pranidhana is about cultivating a relationship with Ishwara. Leave out the literal definition of trustful surrender. I need a relationship with whatever this higher reality that we're terming as Ishvara is all about. I need to find my connection. I need to find how this higher reality, what it means to me, where my connection point is, and how I can draw the nourishment, guidance, and protection when I need it. That's exactly what 124 to 126 are saying, that Ishvara is our inner guide, our source. Ishvara Pranidhana is what we need to do to connect. We offer ourselves to that reality, and that reality opens limitless potential to us when we allow ourselves to be embraced by it. So there's many, many, many different degrees of Ishvara Pranidhana, just like we talked about with Vairagya and Samadhi. It's a continual process. It's a spectrum. It's not an on and off state. Ishvara Pranidhana that leads us to higher forms of Samadhi is like this amazing quantum leap. We'll leave that aside for a moment. But there are many, many different dimensions of Ishvara Pranidhana where our relationship to our inner teacher unfolds and our capacity to derive nourishment, guidance, and protection becomes more and more real to us. And in, directly in proportion to that relationship, all the rest of our Abhyasa and Vairagya unfold themselves. They go back and forth. 127 to 129 seem to take us in a different direction, which at face value sometimes looks like something else new entirely is being put forward. What I just shared was that, for me, Ishvara Pranidhana is finding our relationship with Ishvara. And we've understood that Ishvara holds tremendous potential for our inner growth, this inner teacher, source of protection and guidance. How do I connect? How do I meaningfully engage with Ishvara Pranidhana? I know it's not just reaching the end of my wit's end and just collapsing in surrender. It's not what it's all about. If I'm truly tired, all I need to do is ask for help. And that's called asking for help. That's not called surrendering. That's called acknowledging that we have a source. That's great. How do I do that? How do I seek help and guidance? How do I form a meaningful relationship with the reality which we know is beyond what I can see, smell, taste, touch, hear? It's more than I can connect with right now. What do I do? Sutra 127. Tasya vachakaha pranava. Literally, that pranava is the denoter of that Ishvara. Literally, pranava is the name of Ishvara. What is pranava? Om. So you're saying that Om is the name of God and that all you have to do is know the name of God and everything is done? Simple as that? That sounds way too simple. And I've already tried, it didn't work, so let me move on. It is that simple and it isn't that simple. And the key thing here to look at, which is where this commentary is so beautiful, is what this word pranava is all about. Page 136. The literal meaning of pranava is that which is precisely, astoundingly, or uniquely new. Pranava refers to the power that breathes a notable newness into us. According to Mantra Shastra, the science of mantra, the infallible transformative power of Ishvara is pranava. Infallible transformational potential of Ishvara, the essence of Ishvara, that pulsation of Ishvara is pranava, which allows us to find that newness in ourselves and in the world. What is newness? It's growth. Some aspect of ourself that we haven't already understood. And remember, it's not more, but rather newness in terms of subtlety, expansiveness, potency. So pranava is something much more than auditory sound, or which is how we usually think of mantra. It's that much more essential dimension of sacred sound, which contains the infallible transformational potential of Ishwara. Ishwara is that power to be and the power to become, taken slightly from more of a tantric perspective. That's what's referred to here as that infallible power of change, transformation, growth. It's everything of Ishwara condensed into a focal point, which is perhaps why it's what Patanjali brings in the sutra. Immediately after Patanjali makes a very bold, almost such a bold statement that it's a little scary, that Ishwara Pranidhana is the way to reach samadhi. Ishwara is this extraordinarily, such an extraordinary reality that's almost outside of the scope of our imagination. It's the essence of perfection. This essence is our inner teacher, and we need to find a way to form a relationship with that inner teacher. Inner teacher is always available to us. We need to be present to that. Pranava, power of mantra, is the most potent way to form that relationship. One more thing might be implicit here, that we need to broaden our understanding beyond what we currently think mantra to be. There's more to mantra than sound, and which is why this definition of pranava to me is so intriguing and worth coming back to again and again. That which is precisely, astoundingly, or uniquely new. So it's the essence of Ishwara, which is most vividly expressed through sacred sound. But there's more to it than sacred sound. Mantra is, this pranava, I should say, is a discrete living reality that breathes newness and richness into our life and becomes a connection point between our reality and Ishwara. What do I do with pranava? 128. Repetition of that, pranava, means to reflect on its meaning. So, mantra, as sacred sound, is usually practiced by repeating it, usually silently. This is a concept that's very familiar in the path of yoga and many, many other spiritual traditions, to remember a sacred sound. That is definitely part of how we work with mantra. But go back and see that we're saying pranava. This essence that is the very epitome of newness, richness, growth, transformation. We engage with this by reflecting on its meaning. Meaning is not the literal meaning of the word, but rather the life force, the essence, the purpose which brought that pranava to us, into the world. This might sound a little bit too esoteric, but the reason why it's important is that if we're saying that it's the literal meaning of a word, many of these mantras have no literal meaning, or they're so technically challenging to arrive at that we never are sure whether or not it's the right meaning. We're not looking to find the literal meaning of the word. We're looking to see what the hidden essence of this pranava is all about and allow that to transform us from the inside out. Another way of looking at pranava is that it's a unique experience that's been condensed and expressed through sacred sound. That experience really is the experience of samadhi, the experience of Ishwara. That there have been unique experiences, human experiences, that bridge the mundane and the transcendent. And that experience crystallized in what we're calling pranava. It's like an echo of a primordial Big Bang. It's that vibrational potential which still continues to ring today from that kind of Big Bang experience of Ishvara. The vibration of Ishvara is contained in pranava, which is why repeating that pranava, digesting it, absorbing it, allowing it to be the focal point of our peaceful flow of awareness, why that leads us to Ishvara. 129. Therefrom, meaning from japa, from reflection on the meaning of pranava, sacred sound, comes the experience of inner being as well as the elimination of impediments. Another, even from the word breakup that's in the commentary here, comes the experience of an inward flowing awareness, is another way of saying inner being. Pratyak chetanadigama, an inner flowing consciousness. We experience Ishvara within us through japa, that seed of consciousness, as well as the elimination of impediments. At first glance, it seems a little strange that both of those are put in the same sutra. Japa allows us to experience our inner being, our inner consciousness, and by the way, it also helps us to get rid of those obstacles. The point that's being made here, in part, is that our pathway to experiencing our inner being, inner consciousness, is nowhere near as difficult as we think, provided that we work systematically and are gifted with the capacity to transform and transcend our obstacles. That, and this comes from the introduction of this commentary, there's a beautiful statement which is made, that we have a lot of acquired tendencies, but our innate quality of mind, our intrinsic being, is perfection. It is samadhi. We're not creating samadhi, we're unveiling whatever was already there. And that's where we need help. Our abhyasa and vairagya is a process of transforming and transcending all of the obstacles which are on our path, which impede the flow of consciousness or veil its presence. So this removal of obstacles on the path might seem trivial, especially if we're making the obstacles really small. No obstacle is too big or too small if it's an obstacle. Japa allows us to find freedom from our obstacles. Big statement. As big as the statement that japa gives us an experience of our inner awareness, the consciousness within, our inner being. And this is the end of a cluster of sutras, and then from here begin another set. But the important thing to look at as we conclude is that Ishvara is absolutely a central concept of yoga. I wouldn't say that these sutras are telling us whether or not we need to believe in God. That's usually the other thing which is very heavily written on, especially in scholarly approaches. Did Patanjali believe in God? Does yoga require us to believe in God? And it's quite popular now. To me, that's asking the wrong question. The interesting question here is, what does Ishvara have to do with my inner journey? Where can abhyasa and vairagya take me? And how is a meaningful relationship with higher reality the gateway to achieving more and to reaching samadhi more specifically? And what I've seen in my own life is that these sutras are ones that are worth coming back to time and time again, really reflecting on, beginning from 123 all the way to 129, but first just 123 to 126. What is Patanjali trying to help us understand about Ishvara? This is the essence of Ishvara, the broad strokes, the framework, but there's much, much more. This isn't the only thing we could say about Ishvara. But this is what we need to know about Ishvara so that we can make progress on our journey. This is meant for us. Patanjali wasn't trying to show how smart he was and tell us everything about Ishvara. This is exactly what we need to know as seekers on the path of Abhyasa and Vairagya, looking to experience the best in ourself and experience that best in ourself in a way which is lasting and real, aka reach samadhi. We don't want to just hit a peak and then again come back and again go back and forth. We want to find a way where our growth is stable, that expansion is stable, and it really takes us to wherever we need to go. That's where Ishvara Pranidhana comes in. And that's where the study of Ishvara really comes in, to reflect on why Patanjali defines Ishvara in this really interesting way, as a higher reality that's free from all these limitations. And that this reality, because it's free from all these limitations, is the source of all guidance, protection, and nourishment. The inner teacher. This is a gift that we have. It's inbuilt, that we're born with. All we need to do is have a relationship with this reality. To do so, the best way, the fastest way, is through pranava. This may or may not imply that it only means mantra and mantra japa, which is a much smaller slice of the totality of the path of yoga and everything that's connected to yoga. In part, it's correct to say that we're talking about practice of mantra. But I would say read those sutras 127 to 29 with another pair of eyes and see how the word pranava, that which breathes infallible newness and richness into our life, is something which we can find even outside of the scope of mantra. Mantra is just a very, very, very condensed pool of pranava. Which is why it's like the quintessential form of pranava. There's many other ways to look at this. And just as a side note or something intriguing to think about, reflect on the idea of prana when you look at pranava. And that'll really open up a lot more to think about. It'll also allow us to see how the eight limbs connect back to pranava outside of the scope of what we might today consider a very narrow sliver of mantra japa meditation, which might feel like it's not for me right now. It's very rich. And that through pranava, we gain, through a meaningful experience of pranava, reflecting on the meaning of pranava and being absorbed in that meaning, we gain an experience of Ishvara within and the elimination of all the obstacles on our path. Then the road to samadhi becomes much more clear. And then from there continues a discussion on these obstacles and more ways to attenuate them. And that's where we'll begin next week.